Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Krang, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kale Teeter, and Russell Young, discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on LinkedIn.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 513, being recorded on the 26th of February, 2025. Today we have Kendall, Evan, and myself, and we're here to talk about, a special roundtable discussion on Azure Container Apps. I know we've talked about it in the past, but I think we want to get down to an additional level of detail in what kind of apps you can run there, what kind of workloads are best suited for Azure Container Apps, what are some of the features and pitfalls you need to watch for. I've been doing some work with Container Apps. Of course, we've got our expert Kendall as well, who's also very knowledgeable. She used to be part of that team at Microsoft, and it has components of Dapper as well, and you know she's very familiar with that as well in her current role. So we'll get to all of that, but before that, let's just cover some news updates. I'll go first. So I've got about maybe six of them here, so I'll go through them real quick. So we've got Azure load testing. We know that you can create these load tests in Azure now, and kind of make sure that your apps and your infrastructure is working correctly. You can now schedule the load test to run at a particular time. You can schedule it to run later at night. Maybe you want to run it when there's less traffic on the system. Or you want to run it on a regular basis, like as part of a regular sanity check to make sure the environment is performing well. So that's now available. You can schedule these load tests, which is a nice thing. Another update and this is more like a deprecation. I don't know if Kendall, if you use Azure Data Studio, it used to be like this IDE for DBAs kind of thing. I remember using it a few times, and unfortunately, they are deprecating that in favor of VS Code, because VS Code now has such a big, rich ecosystem of all of these extensions. There's no need to have like a standalone IDE just for Azure Data Studio. So that's going to be deprecated, I think, in about a year from now. And so if you're using that, there is already extensions that are available in VS Code, which will do with the same functionality. And there's a nice migration story as well from Azure Data Studio over to the VS Code extensions. Third one is about log analytics. And, Evan, I don't know if you saw this recently. I was troubleshooting some container apps issues just recently and using the log analytics. And it kind of defaults to this new simple mode, or it kind of asks you, hey, do you want to use the simple mode in log analytics? Because typically, you'd have to figure out which table you want to look at and do some drop in some KQL query. And, they always dumped me for a little while. So now they have the simple mode where it's kind of, you don't have to know anything, right? You just pick a couple of things from a dropdown and boom, you get the results. So I thought that was pretty nice, at least for somebody who's a newbie to KQL like I am.
I it's funny to hear you say that, because I flipped the setting around, because I kept going into it. I'm like, I don't want the simple setting. I know the query I want to run. And so, right. It all depends on sort of what your persona is.
You're on on the other edge of the extreme of the spectrum. The next one is was very cool. I think I saw a demo of this at one of the internal Microsoft demo days. It's the Azure Databricks Clean Rooms. Okay. And what a clean room is that, Microsoft, my company is collaborating with a partner of some sort, right? And we want to share some data. We want to make sure that if we combine our two data sets, maybe there's some additional value that can be gleaned out of that. Now, the problem is that, I'm not ready to share everything with the partner, and the partner is ready to share everything with me. So we all meet up in this clean room that is an Azure Databricks clean room, where there's nothing in there except for whatever we want to share. The partners want to share, they can share specific data items, fields, metadata, whatever it is. And they can even share a notebook. They say they can tell the other partner, hey, here's a notebook. You can go run it and see what my data is like. So it's a very curated way for the other, each one to see the other person's data, right? And then this way they can kind of collaborate and say, oh, yeah, you know, if we combine these two tables, we might be able to get something valuable out of this collaboration. So that's what Azure Databricks is. It's a way for two parties to kind of collaborate in a safe space and not have to expose all of their internal data or secret sauce, if that's the case. I know this the one about the data box devices, I think you had on yours, Evan, so I'll let you cover that. And then the final one I have is Azure API Center. I think we have that covered recently, but now you can point to an Amazon API gateway and it will grab all the APIs from there as well. So now, you know, API Center is this place where you're supposed to have a full inventory of all the APIs in your company, so that if anybody wants to reuse APIs, they have one place to go to find the APIs. And so this is another way for it to go and grab the APIs from Amazon API gateway, which you may have deployed, and that'll be added to the catalog, so that if somebody now wants to say, hey, you know, how do I do this, what API do I use for this, and, you know, hopefully that
If I understand that, Sudhi, that basically allows them, the API can be published wherever they just can use it, right? They don't have to care about the publication.
Correct. Location. They'll be okay. Like the open API definition, yeah, of it, yeah, right, will be there. Yeah. So they can read about it. They can see what it's for, how, what kind of authentication, get the schemas, et cetera. Yeah. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. Makes sense.
Ooh, yeah. So that's what I had. Evan, I know you had a few.
Yeah, I had a couple. Some of these are really about prepping yourself for things that are coming. Some of them are new features. You know, the first thing is, and I don't think we've ever talked about it on the show, but the Azure Data Box, you know, which I always thought was this coolest technology, because basically we ship you this hardened container with a bunch of drives in it, and you can copy your data onto it, and then you can send it to us
and just to be clear, when we say container, we mean an actual container.
Yeah, actual physical container
we were talking about earlier.
Actual, that's actually funny, I didn't even think about that, but yeah, absolutely, an actual physical container you can put your hands on, and it's, you know, squarish or rectangularish in thing, but these are just, you know, super padded, super robust things. You copy your data over, it gets to us in a secure fashion, and you can get it into your storage accounts. Because again, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I was pretty excited when I got 1 gig up recently on Fiverr. But like, if I got terabytes and terabytes and terabytes or petabytes worth of data, like, you just, it's just not feasible to upload. So sometimes you do have to be able to ship it. From a deprecation perspective, TLS 1.1 is almost completely gone at this point, but we just announced that HD Insight is going to deprecate it. I think it's actually coming up the end of this month where it no longer will accept connections from it. These are two database ones on MySQL, and I thought this was really cool as someone who lives on the reliability side of things. We now have the virtual canary program for MySQL, which allows you to basically opt into early updates, you know, regardless of where you are in the globe, which is great. Put your dev test on them. You know, if something ships that breaks you, let us know, you know, so that we can stop it or fix it before it gets to the rest of the fleet. And then also, if you're in the on-premises world using SQL Server and you're looking to go to SQL MI, there's a modernization advisor, which actually looks at your data, it runs a bunch of queries, it looks at your performance data and says, hey, you should go use this MI config. And yes, you're a good candidate for MI versus you're not, which again is great, because I'm sure we've all worked with somebody who migrated to a platform and went, oh, after the fact, this doesn't work, and now I can't get back, right? So it's great to have that advice up front. Similar along the same vein, the modern data movement library, this is basically rebuilding the storage libraries to take it to be multi-platform in essence, for the, you know, to allow you to move data around within blob storage and around within file storage. Now, you know, this is, I think, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure this is using, you know, one of the .NET Core libraries or .NET standard libraries that's now multi-platform. You can use it anywhere. Again, a really nice advancement to not being limited, you know, if you're not on the Windows platform. And the last thing I want to mention is private DNS, zones fallback, internet fallback, sort of a long name for historically you had private DNS, which is for your resources. And then if you need public DNS, you had to stand up a DNS server. And that sort of undercuts the whole point of having infrastructure or platform as a service. And so now we've added to private DNS zones the ability to fall back to domain lookups with secondary servers that would have this. And so you can just point to another DNS server somewhere in the world, or you can just use our built-in ones that exist in Azure. And so now you can sort of have this fully, I don't know if it's either SaaS or PaaS at this point. I'm actually not sure which one this would be in this state, but it's definitely not infrastructure as a service through your DNS. You can leverage the platform to do it for you. And now you have this whole full feature capability there.
You forgot there's a new buzzword on the scene, which is what as it's like agents as a service. This is now.
Oh God, just what I need. Another as a service.
It was like, SaaS, dad, as coming. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to keep adding to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's because as a service sounds cooler than just service, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Funny. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a good roundup of all the news. So let's get to our topic today. I think, I wonder if I recall the last time we talked about container apps, it was you, Kendall, who had kind of being the guest on the show, right? I think it was a few moons ago, I would say.
Yeah, oh my goodness. I've been at Diagonauters, which is insane to me.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Time is truly flying. But yeah, I know. I think the last time we did it on the podcast was when I was still on the team. And obviously that team is like thriving and I think the service is doing super, super well. So yeah, we even did like a recent state of Dapper survey. And we haven't released the results, so I'm not going to like give too much away, but there's definitely a lot of growth of like even Dapper usage on non-Kubernetes platforms like container apps, especially within Azure. So clearly. And I mean, there's a lot of great updates that we can obviously chat about. I know, Sajid, like you said, you've been using it. I still definitely dabble in the sense that I like keep up to date and I like read through the GitHub issues. Like I feel like I just like can't fully let it go because obviously my career, but there's definitely some cool stuff that container apps is doing, especially within like the newer like agent space features. So happy to be able to talk about it today. I know they have a great team too, so we'll have to go on their PMs on a few months.
And I was actually troubleshooting some issues and I looked it up and it pointed me to a GitHub issue. And of course your name was on that issue. I'm like, oh goodness me, can't get away from her.
Yeah, she's everywhere.
But let's sort of refresh everybody on what ACA is. Just to like a minute, I think, just to ground us as well on kind of what the purpose of ACA, because it's always been, it's been said that this is a serverless container platform, right? But it's such a kind of a generic buzzword because everyone like ACI is a serverless container platform. I guess in some ways app services is also so. How would you characterize, Kendall, as ACI? Like what's different about ACI when you call it a serverless container platform?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, container apps is like the amalgamation of knowledge learned from all of these platforms that have existed at Microsoft. Like obviously app service, probably one of the most revolutionary, like developer centric hosting platforms on Azure at the time. And it had all the bells and whistles. It made deploying these web apps a lot less complicated. And then obviously adding some of these really great, benefits of the cloud features where you had authentication, where you could hook it up and you could hook up a database really easily. And you could do some of this networking configuration with more like a more seamless process. So I feel like, we had kind of the app service of the world and we had things like Azure Functions come along. We have stuff like ACI. And to me, like container apps really came to be the best of all the learnings from those platforms, because obviously as containerization became more emergent, I feel like it was no longer even just like an app service sufficient to just be able to run a single container. And so they had Docker Compose support an app service, and then you had the emergence of Kubernetes. And so then it was sort of like you had this app service experience that was really out of the box, made it super easy to work with. And then you basically had this Kubernetes platform, which had been open source from Google, which was like extremely complicated, right? Like it was hosting a lot, it was basically running google.com, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not an easy service to run and operate. And for a lot of use cases, it's it's a lot of overhead, maybe even unnecessarily so. So I think like the learnings of AKS growing and evolving, and that's great. There's teams that want to be able to manage and run containers at scale. They have that. But then you had kind of the people running app service who are growing beyond the sort of Docker compose multi-container option, and they needed more flexibility. And to me, like container apps was kind of the best of both worlds for that, right? I don't have to run Kubernetes. I don't need this severe amount of operational overhead, but I still want things like interconnectivity between containerized workloads. I still want to be able to deploy and run microservices without necessarily sacrificing all of the bells and whistles that I get from an app service, from like a PaaS platform. And so, yeah, I know that's kind of long-winded, but like to me, we called AKS back in the day like IaaS plus plus. I would argue now with like AKS, I think automated or automatic, I think it's called. It's really more of like a, like maybe IaaS plus plus plus. Like it's still not fully PaaS, right? And then right. You have container apps to me, which is like really the evolution of SaaS based service, So
I would say this is what I was going to ask Kendall, because I mean, as you look at AKS, it has gotten more simpler and simpler and simpler to manage, right? The investments are going. Or the investments need to go into that. And so it's not fully PaaS, but it's certainly not IaaS by any stretch, right? But and so it sounds like when we're talking about container apps, we really are talking sort of that revolutionary leap to, I don't have to manage any of my infrastructure. I just care about my actual container. That's all I care about. Is that the right way to think about it?
I think so. Like, I think, and this is as a PM who worked on the container apps in the early days, like I personally had a little bit of like internal conflict of like, there's a lot of customers who maybe just want a more PaaS like features on AKS. Yeah. If for them that's sufficient, and they don't want to lose some of the control, because anytime you go to any kind of like container as a service or like SaaS based platform, you are going to have like some level of
black box. There's trade-offs. There's trade-offs for sure.
That are not exposed. And like, not every company is willing to take on that level of like dependence on a particular provider. Arguably, they're still doing it on AKS. It's just like maybe a little bit less. I would say it's for that user who would like naturally want the kind of PaaS like features of an app service, but they want the scalability of like a Kubernetes, and they want some of the flexible features it provides. So yeah, it's really focusing on the container. And now, which I'm sure Sajid will get to, I feel like in the past 2 years, container apps has really evolved in a lot of ways. Like one of the things I did love about container apps, and before I left, this is one of the things that they kind of, like one of the decisions that was being solidified was like, do we do sort of this dedicated plan, or do we make it a little bit more dynamic than that? And they went with the dynamic feature implementation, which I was really happy about, which was I can actually deploy a container and decide, do I want this to go on to like dedicated hardware and I'll pay a little bit more for this one? Or do I want it to be able to run on kind of the shared community SaaS based hardware? And those two things can interact with each other, not fully isolated, which I think was so critical to this platform being successful, is that you can have such a wide array of workload types that are containerized in ACA, which I think has made it compelling. When you add in container apps jobs for like scheduled jobs for things that run on a timer, you can also do like sandboxed environments, like this dynamic sessions concept where you can basically get like a hostile multi-tenant container running with like Hyper-V isolation. You can also do GPUs, right? You can also run Azure Functions in container apps. So like they really have kind of made it a platform where like it's very dynamic in terms of what you can run, but the underlying hardware is like very much aligned and similar to the hardware you would get with an AKS or an ACI. It's just got a level of abstraction on it.
Right. Like,
Yeah,
that's just really very well put, and you've covered all the key kind of workloads of ACA, which is nice.
She might be deep in this, in some fashion, right?
She's dusting off the rocks.
You know what I like about ACA, just to add to what Kendall said, is that it's like serverless Kubernetes, right? If you want to call it that, right? It's Kubernetes, but you don't have to think about the server. So it's like serverless Kubernetes, and they've done a lot of work to improve the developer experience, right? I think that was the big problem with AKS. Oh, I got to create these YAML files. I got 500 YAML files, replica sets and this and that all over the place, and it got a little bit out of hand. So this way, they have simplified that deployment, right? It's, there's one way to deploy it. It's a container app. You package your container or containers, and you define how they talk to each other, and it's pretty simple, right? So, but it is, you know, I wanted to kind of talk about how they think about serverless, right? Because under the covers, we all know that there is an AKS cluster somewhere there, right? That's kind of running it. And yet, as Kendall said, they have the consumption plan and they have the dedicated plans, right? And, you know, I've kind of played around with both. They're both nice. The consumption plan is limited to, I think, 4 vCores and 8 gigs of memory. So that means all of your containers in total cannot exceed that amount. Otherwise, you know, you won't be able to schedule any more apps, right? Is that right, Kendall? That doesn't change much since...
That's my understanding, at least
yeah. It was. And then if you need something more than that, then you could use one of the dedicated plans, you know, which give you obviously more capacity, right? And you can scale up. You can have additional instances of those SKUs running. Now, when you say it's serverless, though, I guess so. The what you're paying for in the dedicated plan when you buy that, you're paying for that much of capacity. Right, you're not really paying for the servers. The servers may be more than that, less than that. I don't know. Right, it's because they have under the covers. They probably have to deploy multiple servers for redundancy and whatnot. And so they do all of that. Like the Microsoft would do all of that under the platform. But you know, you're going to get, you know, four vCPUs, 8 gigs of memory, or you know, four vCPUs, 16 gigs of memory if you take the dedicated plan, the lowest dedicated plan. So it's a nice way for developers to think about that. That's my capacity, right? I know I can just run whatever I want in there. And that kind of abstraction really helps for someone who just wants to focus their time on building the containers, building the apps. It's probably like, you know, multiple containers talking to each other. It could be, you know, some API apps. It could be background processing, as Kendall was saying. Event-driven processing, you know, microservices that talk to each other, all of those things. That's what you want to focus on, and you want to just put it up there and have it run reliably.
Where does this leave me if, you know, we're talking about simplifying the platform and losing some levers and knobs that, you know, you might have traditionally flipped in AKS? Where does that leave me if I have to integrate with, like, virtual networks or private endpoints? Does container apps bring with it some of those? Because those are sort of infrastructure-y type things. Again, I think they're on the border, as we, you know, those old descriptions are starting to fall apart. But like, do I still get that, or am I giving, like, traditionally with web services, or excuse me, with web apps, I used to give up a chunk of that kind of stuff. Some of it has been added in recent years, but am I giving that up when I go to container apps, or do I still have at least some of those capabilities to integrate with the rest of my deployments that are not running in this container apps ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sajid and I both can like touch on this, but yeah, you can run an environment that's like an internal environment, or you can have like an environment that is exposed to like.
Okay. So I can sort of do whatever I want from that perspective. I got a lot of those same knobs and levers in terms of connectivity and security and whatnot.
Right. If you don't provide your, if you don't bring your own VNet, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, you can mm-hmm. do that's the sort of the most secure option. But if you don't do that, Microsoft creates a VNet in the Microsoft tenant for you. Gotcha. The caveat is that you cannot see, you cannot do anything in that VNet. It's not visible to you at all. It's there, though. There is a VNet created for you, but you have no idea, you know, you can't see it at all, right? So, so they'll deploy that for you. Obviously, for most deployments, secure deployments will bring their own VNet, bring their own subnet in. It needs a dedicated subnet, right? It needs its own subnet to be able to deploy all the eventually what I just pods, I suppose, into that into that subnet, you know. So yeah, and you know, there are some caveats. So if you want to bring your own VNet, you cannot use the consumption plan, right? The consumption plan is purely, or you know, Microsoft will do everything for you. Obviously, you have to use one of the dedicated plans, which sort of makes sense, right? Because that's the only way they can attach it to your VNet, to your subnet. I do like the fact that it has these scalars built in, right? So this is something that we spend quite a bit of time with in our deployment. We're using HTTP events as well as queue events, right? From using storage queues. And what was interesting is, as Kendall said, you know, you could have just standard ACA apps, Azure Container Apps. Any container in the world you want to bring in there, as long as it runs on Linux, it'll run, right? That's your kind of default position. But if you need something that's a little more event-driven, using something like functions or function apps on ACA, on Azure Container Apps makes a lot of sense, right? And so we did use that. We have used Function Apps. And you know, what I didn't realize, though, when you do that, when you deploy a Function Apps on ACA, it gives you the perception that it's just a regular Function App. So that's what you see. You see a normal Function App as you would if you did it on App Services. Under the covers, what it does is it creates this shadow resource group. Like, you know how AKS creates a shadow resource group with all the VM scale sets and all that?
Managed resource manager.
Same thing. This does a managed resource group under the covers. In that resource group is a single normal container app, right? Which is wrapping your function. So they have a container app, which is, you can see that resource group, you can see that container app, but you can't touch it, right? You can't change anything, right? What I mean is you can see everything, but you can't change anything because that's all managed by the function app. So that was, and they make a lot of assumptions for you when you run function apps, right? So if you're queue triggered, for example, then the scaler automatically works on that queue, right? The scaler will look at that queue, and as the queue is increasing, it's going to spin up additional replicas, which is fine, right? But you can't change any of those parameters. Like if it's, for example, for the queue trigger, unless the queue is at least 5 deep, it wants to scale up another replica. Now, in our case, we wanted to have it scale up much faster, and we just couldn't. We wanted to have it scale up every time there was a message. Like, you know, if there's one single message, we want another replica. If there's another message, we want another replica. In other words, we wanted, you know, replicas to be spun up a lot more quicker. And you don't have that flexibility of doing that with the function app, right? So this is something we have to consider. Like the function app makes a lot of, it's an opinionated scaler that's made available to you. Although the full KEDA scaler ecosystem is available in general to container apps. If you use the function app on ACA only, there's not a whole lot you can do, right? You can just say, I want my minimum and my maximum replicas, and that's the only thing you get to say. So that was like, you know, from a bit of an eye opener, right? And it helps you kind of make some good like application decisions. Where do you put this stuff in ECA?
This brings to me like the conversation, and there's a lot of variants of this, but I have it with a lot of support or engineering teams. Everybody likes to think they're different and they need all the bells and whistles and the levers. But you know, when you're leveraging a platform like container apps, you know, where there's some opinionated decisions about how to do it, it's probably okay for 90-95% of the people. And really, you could probably argue, I suspect, that if what you're doing doesn't fit that opinionated model, you should at least give it a second thought. Doesn't mean you have to change your mind, right? But you should at least go, you know, do I really need, I mean, in your case, right? Do I really need to scale with everywhere? Can I get away with every 5? And you just lose a whole bunch of complexity at that point.
Or the other way is then you realize that maybe that's not the right option for you, right? In our case, that's what we realized. Yeah. I didn't know something like Kendall just said, Azure Container Jobs. I didn't know jobs existed until I went to the portal. I was like, what is this jobs business? And I realized that it's probably equivalent to jobs in Kubernetes, right? Kubernetes has a function of jobs, which is, you start a container, do something, it finishes and it dies, right?
And shut it down. Yeah.
Yeah. And that allowed you to do all the tuning you wanted for scaling, for scalers. So I was able to, you know.
Oh, so you went that route rather than
Oh, okay. So it's a matter of picking the right. I said there's all these workload types available, and you want to pick the right one. Like I said, you got the standard container app, which is sort of the catch-all, any container in the world. Then there's the function. You obviously have to write the function runtime to kind of run there. And then you have jobs, which is really cool for doing these, you know, the one-off processing, which is what we were doing. We're building a Monte Carlo simulation on ACA, right, which runs for a few minutes. And so we have to execute this, this is the perfect place to do it, to do as a jobs. Mm-hmm. And we could scale it up. We got 7 requests in the queue. And it spun up 7 containers immediately without much of a fuss.
Yeah,
I will say, like, and this is more of my like skeptical self, like speaking a little bit, but I do think it's important. Like, I feel like as someone who's been in product now and like someone who has like customers' best interest in mind, like there is a reality in general for like any product that's being developed. Like I want to do things that are innovative and that are interesting and that bring people into the platform to try it out and like that meet a need, right? And like you have a lot of Azure Functions customers in Azure, and like whether or not the utility of that feature is going to be sufficient in order to bring those workloads to the platform, like has to be determined. But like I think sometimes you do need to like have healthy skepticism about new features that come into a product. Yeah. And like I say that as just like a steward of both like good customer practices and just like their nature of like the evolution of the times that we're in. Like things are happening fast. Like there's pressure in order to keep products relevant to developers, and that's extremely hard to do. And so some features aren't going to be all the way like what you really need, right? They might be really cool to try it out and you might be like, oh, you know, this doesn't meet my need, but look, I found jobs, right? So like some features I think really are kind of nice and shiny to try out, but aren't necessarily going to be the thing you want to like hang workload on. And so that's just me being kind of like the healthy skeptic that just says like, you always want to evaluate a product and kind of what the, like where a lot of the investment is going, right? Like for example, in Azure Functions, they have had like a Dapper, they have like an Azure Functions Dapper extension. But like, if you go to the GitHub repo and you kind of play around with it, like it's not something that there's like 10 developers actively on, right? Yeah. Like that, yeah. It unblocks a use case. And for some people that could be sufficient, but like, it's not something I'd probably hang my like hat on, because things do get deprecated and things do go stale. And like, that's just the reality of the state we're in. So I feel like that's another, because once again, if you really want to run Azure Functions, like you can still completely within the VNet have your Azure function talk to a container app, right? It might create a little bit of like deployment, less like deployment idealism, I guess, but there are those options where it's like Azure Functions is continuing to be invested in. It's not going anywhere. Like, what are the core features that have stayed like with just time? And so I just think that's always a good meta.
This takes us a little bit off track, but I think what you're hitting on something I think is really different about this day and age when we talk, you know, and it shows up in containers world, it shows up in the .NET world, right? Like it used to be that you pick your thing that you're using. Hey, I'm using IIS or I'm using ASP.NET. Well, if I'm using ASP.NET, then I'm using IIS. And then chances are I'm using SQL Server. I mean, can I use Oracle? Yeah, but it's, you know, you got a driver that's not maintained, or maybe Microsoft shipped it for this third party, right? I actually remember those days, you know, but now it's, you know, if I'm doing a container, I have a lot of different places I can run it so that my piece of my code, the stuff that I care about, is under my full control. But like, am I married to AKS versus container apps versus, you know, roll your own Kubernetes? Like you have a lot of flexibility without losing the core, right, of your specifics. And I think the same is true with, you know, .NET's now multi-platform, right? Like that's just, you're right in the sense of things come and go because they don't always land. Mm-hmm. But I do think it does, you know, sort of encourage us to make good decisions about, I'm picking the piece of this that is critical to my, like is my own IP in it, my own sort of customized stuff. And you know what, that infrastructure, like how VM1 talks to VM2 or Resource1 talks to Resource2, like I can abstract that. There's probably lots of ways I can do that. I'm not married to that, but my code I can't change. So that's right. What I have to own. But I think that's a good thing, right? To look at it that way.
It is good. And it means that you dictate what is invested in. Like that's the other thing. That it's like the things that mean something to you and like advocate for those things, because those are the things where that's where the investment's going to go, is where customers put their energy. And so, you know, not every feature can be priority number one, right? It has to be the thing that are getting the most value for customers.
I do like the way that ACA had included some of the most popular open source projects, for example, Envoy, the Ingress Controller, you know, the Dapper, of course, and Kata, right? The things that we all had to manually deploy on AKS deployments every time. It was a pain in the neck sometimes. It was always a hassle. That's just out of the box available and so well integrated in all of these workloads I talked about, you know, functions, jobs, even just container apps. So that was really well done. One thing that I did, I can struggle with was accessing file shares from container apps, right? This is, so there is obviously Azure File Shares, you know, which is our storage solution. In Azure Storage Account, you can create a file share and you can access that from ACA. The two options, as you know, are SMB and NFS, right? Those are the two options. They just recently added NFS support into ACA. I don't know if that was there when you left Kindle, but the problem is that both of them have their pros and cons. Like for example, to access the SMB endpoint, you have to use storage keys. I mean, in this day and age, nobody uses storage keys in storage accounts. But unfortunately, that's the only way it works, right? That's a limitation.
So there's no Entra integration at that
point? Nope, okay. Nope. Okay, so then the second option, I said, okay, let's look at NFS. NFS doesn't require storage keys. Guess what? NFS doesn't require any authentication whatsoever. That's the beauty of it. But it only works in your VNet. It has to be VNet connected to your private endpoint, and it's VNet attached. So the idea is that, okay, if it's attached to the VNet, and you know, then
it's
you're
safe. Yeah.
It's supposed to be just you, right? Nobody else there. So you know, that's again another caveat. Like, a lot of these containers are going to need storage, right? We do have container scope storage available. We have replica scope storage, and then the whole, you know, the general purpose storage is the file share. These are, you know, there's some things that the customers have to just be careful that, you know, this is what they're going to get it to. There's unfortunately, Azure NetApp is not yet supported, so we're still waiting for that. Ideally, that would be nice to, you know, to have that sort of managed identity support with storage. But, you know, again, it's not the end of the world. I think, you know, being that it's all been the VNet, I think NFS is a good option. It's not something we're going to we're going to take that option most likely. And I think you mentioned about the dynamic sessions, Kendall. I'm impressed that you knew about that, because I only just found out about that this week, about dynamic sessions.
I still keep up with some of the, like, PMs, at least, like, their LinkedIn's and stuff. Hopefully I see, like, when
you saw that,
super excited to, like, because they worked on it, so makes it a little bit easier to just, like,
and then there was actually an update. One of the updates in today's news was about that. So let me talk about what dynamic sessions is and what I understand. And Kendall, please correct me if I'm wrong. But a good use case is that if you, if today we have LLMs that generate source code, right? So you have an LLM and you ask it to do something, it'll spit out some source code, and you want to run the source code. You want to execute it. Typically, it's a Python or JavaScript, which can be run as an interpreted language. And you certainly don't want to execute it on your app service, because if it's bad code, or if the code, you know, it's AI generated code. We don't know if it actually works, right? It could be doing something really bad. You don't want to screw up your app service environment, right? And so this is a way where you can take that snippet of code, put it into ACA, into a sandbox environment, and say, hey, run this code for me and give me the output, right? Let me know what the output is. And so that's what these dynamic sessions are. It kind of gives you a code interpreter container sort of in ACA to say, run my code in the sandbox. Even if it screws up, it's not going to do anything malicious other than that particular instance would break. Right off the sandbox would break. Is that correct? Is that a good explanation?
100%. Like, one thing that's funny is, like, when I started learning about containers years ago, I remember that the way that, like, Windows containers basically worked was, like, through this kind of, like, Hyper-V isolation.
Yeah, it was,
like,
all VM construct.
Yeah, like, you put it on, or, like, I think it was Linux containers, sorry. That, like, it was, like, the way that the Linux containers could work on Windows was, like, through this kind of, like, Hyper-V isolation. Like, it was one of the two. I'm getting it mixed up, because now I'm, like, such a Linux user and such a Mac user that it's hard for me to remember. But, like, there was a way that you could run both. Like, you could run Linux container. Oh, that was it. Docker. Docker could run Windows containers through Hyper-V isolation. That's right. Basically what it was. And so it's kind of like, I mean, it's similar to that, right? You kind of have, I think Lighthouse is another one. Like, you have these utility VM concepts. I think, I'm sure Microsoft has some of them. I know other cloud providers do as well. I think Firecracker is, like, one of the, came out of one of the like, functions JavaScript companies that does, like, hosting, where you just get this next level of security and isolation from the other containers. And yeah, I think it's really cool. If anyone's interested in kind of learning about this, like, agentic workload stuff, like the stuff that Sajid was basically talking about, there is this really cool course that I just came upon. So I feel like I'll share it. But, like, Hugging Face just came out with, they're, like, one of the big players. They've created, like, their own models. They, they've come out with, like, an agents course. It's completely free. You can get certified. Nice. Like, they have, yeah. So it's literally, like, actively ongoing. Like, I think you have to finish by, like, within the next couple of months to actually get, like, the certification, but they kind of walk you through what are agents, you know, what is this concept of, like, what do you mean? Like, it's going to run code on its own for this concept of tools. Like, if any of that just sounds foreign to you, but you're in this space, like, I really recommend that, because I feel like it's helped me get up to speed a lot with, like, how agents work in general, how they interact with LLMs, what the different components of it are. So yeah, I think dynamic sessions is actually really, really cool. It's one of the things I want to try out. I also want to try out the path-based routing, because this was sort of like a hindrance when I was on the team, is that, like, if you wanted to get path-based routing, you basically had to kind of, like, deploy your own Nginx container, or, like, figure out how you would do routing within the container apps environment. So I think they have, like, from what I saw, an early access of path-based routing as of, like, November, which is really cool. They also did if you haven't used it in a while. I did know that they did this, but .NET Aspire is huge. Like, as someone who doesn't work at Microsoft anymore, like, especially in the Dapper space, we have a lot of .NET developers using .NET Aspire, which is basically kind of like a local development tool for dashboarding and visibility into the workload. But now you can, like, deploy one into the container apps environment to get better visibility, which I think is really great. The only other thing I was going to say, just like while I'm on a roll here, is one of the challenges with container apps, and this is as someone who, like, is super involved in the Dapper space, is just like version availability. Like, this is kind of like a chronic problem for the past couple of years since I left. Like, I think that the Dapper versioning is around the same as when I left. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is that, like, customers who want to use the latest and greatest in Dapper, which I can guarantee you is evolving as fast as, like, the rest of the tech space right now, it's just hard to get a new version in, right? You have a lot of customers that are now relying on the platform. You have to do it in a really intentional way. And even though there's not breaking changes necessarily, like, I don't think necessarily it's like a breaking change thing. It's just, you have to be super intentional about these, the versioning and maintenance of these open source projects. And so that is one thing I'm kind of like watching from the sideline on a little bit, is like new CADA version, new Dapper version getting there. Cause frankly, like, I can't imagine the explosion you would see in container apps Dapper usage if workflows were available. And because they're not, I feel like it's just hindering a little bit, because that's like the fastest growing Dapper EI today, which I do think there's some really great workflow stuff happening around like durable functions at Microsoft, but just something to like be mindful of, is like that can be something that you're kind of dependent on the provider to get that version updated, and that can come with challenges because you don't have control over that. So,
yeah. Since you talked about the path-based routing, I was also impressed with the traffic splitting feature in ACA. That was very cool, where you can publish a new version or a new revision, as they call it, of the app, and say, I want 20% to go to the new one, 80% to go to the AB or something. Yeah. It was very nice, you know, the way that all works. So that, again, it makes the developer's life so much easier. So
it was... sounds like they've gotten like way more robust about that too. Like, I think they had the fundamentals of that when I was there, but it sounds like they've invested in that a lot more and like made it more robust. So if you haven't played with container apps in a while, or if you have never used it, it sounds like that's actually quite a robust feature.
And the scale to zero actually works very well. So in the consumption plan, like zero replica, then just kind of, you know, there's a little caveat to do. At zero replicas, it doesn't mean it charges you nothing. It charges you a very small, like a quarter of one instance, I think, to keep it warm. So that's how it is. Yeah, it's like a warm cost or something like that. And then, of course, that means that the first request that comes in, it scales from 0 to 1 almost immediately. And so, you know, you can get going. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of good things there. And certainly looking forward to getting this thing into production at my customer. Now, we're going to be using everything. We're going to be using container apps, functions, and jobs, all three. So we have the full deck over here.
Very cool. Cool. It's just fun to get to chat about this. I've missed you guys, and also just talk about.
Thanks so much for coming in. And he said you were there for the right topic discussion. So glad you joined us. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up over here. And you know, I'll put some links in the show notes from you know, some of my research that I had to do to come to figure out some of these things. And and look forward to chatting with you guys next time.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on LinkedIn. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.